We're in chapter 18, verses 1 through 8. Now, I know I didn't even send that out until today. I was kind of wrestling with the passage and where I'm going to break it. Anyone have a chance to look at it? Okay. First impressions? How about, is that all? Okay. Well, we'll look at it and see what we think.
I can't imagine that he would do that for every passerby, unless nobody passes by.
So the question is, would he really just do that because someone's passing by? Interesting. Let's look at that and see. Let's think about that. Well, there's our text, again, in a nice kind of compact way, so the way that Barb likes to see it, all compressed so you can barely see anything. I know. But that way it's all there. Let me read it.
I guess he didn't warn his wife about this Latin thing, though.
Pardon me?
I guess he didn't warn his wife about this Latin.
That's right. And, good. And let me read it, and I want you to watch for the who's, and we'll come back and talk who's. Then the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre, as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. So he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the ground and said, "My Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. And I will bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts. After that you may pass by inasmuch as you have come to your servant." They said, "Do as you have said." So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quickly, make ready three measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes." And Abraham ran to the herd, took a tender and good calf, gave it to a young man, and he hastened to prepare it. And so he took butter and milk and the calf which he had prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree as they ate. What kind of who's do you know?
Abraham.
The Lord. Three young men.
Sarah.
A young servant man. Mm-hmm. That sounds like about what I've got. So not quite as many characters as our last passage together. They were all over the place. So just this is kind of a small interaction in many ways. Okay, good. But we have some of the main characters, and that will become significant as to who they are in coming verses, or as we continue. Let's ask the question, where? And we're told it's by the terebinth trees of Mamre. Do we remember anything about that? Does the name Mamre sound familiar to us?
Where Abraham buried his wife.
Oh, okay, he buries his wife in this area. Yes, she's still alive at this point, obviously, but he's going to bury his wife in this area.
Did God already appear to him under this tree? No.
Did God appear to him under this tree? I'm not sure. Isn't Mamre one of his friends that went with him in the battle against the kings? So Mamre's a person, if I recall correctly. Oh, and terebinth trees may be an oak. So here's this fellow that has this... this wooded area is part of his territory. Okay. So now we want to look at where. And so I've got a little map here, and I want to get a little tricky with you here. I've mentioned before an app that you can use. And so I'm going to see if I can show it to you on here. And Kyle's getting nervous because you get me and technology together, and it gets scary quickly. Yeah, that's the secret code. Okay, so... here are some of my apps in my little Bible folder. So I don't know if the Android phones have this app or not. So for those of you who have the iPhone, you see the one at the top middle there that's called Bible Map. Now I'm going to get tricky on you and flip it over. So down here in the middle, you see the what looks like what? Very good, a Bible, since this is Bible Maps. I click on it, and you can tell I've already been looking at it. It brings up the passage Genesis 18. So you can search for it and get to the text. This is the text. But you notice, see the Mamre there. I could click. Well, let's see what happens if I click that. It brings me right to it on the map. Okay. Or I can just do it this way and say, show me the locations. And there's three of them. But here is where Mamre is in Genesis 18. So let's go way out. There's the Mediterranean Sea. Give you some perspective, okay? Italy's up that way and Greece this way. This is modern-day Turkey, or in the ancient world, in New Testament times, Asia Minor. And down here is Israel. Here's Syria, Jordan, Lebanon. So that's all in the news these days, right? And again, when you think about it and you see it in a big perspective, that's all pretty small. So now scooting that in and expanding a little bit, let's look at where all this was happening. So here is Hebron, which is basically where the Oaks of Mamre are. It's right in the region of it, modern day Hebron. And if you look at this carefully, you'll notice this map here, the line. This is what this region's called, the West Bank, because it's on the west bank of the Jordan River. So see, this red line is the border to Jordan. This red line is the border to the West Bank. And over here you see the Gaza Strip. But, and later on, Hebron is where, well, we'll talk about it, that's where the patriarchs bury. And in this region, this is going to be Sodom and Gomorrah on this map. Yeah, the archaeologists aren't convinced for sure exactly we know that, but we know where Hebron is. So here's the Dead Sea, Jordan River, and if we go up the Jordan River, there's the Sea of Galilee, Nazareth. You kind of get the picture of it. So Hebron is about 20 miles south of Jerusalem. Bethlehem's about 5 or 6 miles south. Okay, any questions on that?
Fine line between teaching and showing off, Drake.
I'm not showing off anything here. Trust me. Okay. So, it's scary to think of me using this technology. Okay.
So did both Jordan and Israel claim the Jordan River? Looks like the line goes right up there.
They claim a half of it. And so, for example, if you go to the traditional site of the baptism of Jesus, that's a good place to visit. It's kind of just, it's like further down than, if you want to get baptized in the Jordan River, like Jesus did, you do it just south of the Sea of Galilee. If you go to the traditional site, you'll be very scared of what illnesses you'll come out of the water with. It's kind of nasty looking. But on the other side, there's a Jordanian side baptismal site and a Israeli site baptismal site. So it's right there. I mean, they're right across from each other. They split the river and they kind of split the Dead Sea. Needless to say, one of the constant problems in the Middle East is water. Desalinization plants are a big deal in Israel, and they're actually trying to work out a project. There's been some good rain this year, but not nearly enough. The Dead Sea is dying. It's going away, and the Sea of Galilee is really low. They're thinking about bringing in ocean water, desaling it, using desalinization and try and build up this area. So, but yeah, they both kind of claim it. Well, let's go back to our other source here to look at our PowerPoint again. And so some of those maps I think you will see on your handout. Yeah, this is on your handout. You can see kind of the general frame of it, and then if we zoom in, it looks like that. Here's modern-day Hebron. Hebron, you'll hear some people pronounce it. Hebron would be the Hebrew way of pronouncing it. Do you see the kind of an interesting structure right in the middle of our picture? Now, by the way, do you think it looked this crowded when Abram was there? No, okay. Not exactly. That old structure that's in the middle that you see, here it is kind of close up. This actually was built by Herod over the site of the burial, over the site of what is the cave of Machpelah, where Abram and Sarah are buried. And so it's sacred to Jews and Muslims alike because the Muslims also claim Abraham. So, but it's interestingly, it's in the West Bank, so it's under Arab control, though under the sovereignty of Israel right now. So anyway, this is a remarkably historic site. Usually today, you can't go there. You have to get a special kind of tour to be able to get to there because of the political ramifications. But that's what's in Hebron today. And so think about it. This structure goes back to the days of Jesus. King Herod built this in the days of Jesus. So it's 2,000 years. This structure is 2,000 years old to honor a site from Abraham, which was 2,000 years before him. And that's, not to say as old as dirt, that's remarkable. So let's talk about these three men that are mentioned in the who's. It says, then the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre as he was sitting in the tent in the heat of day. 18:10, and he said, I will certainly return to you according to the term of life, and behold, Sarah, your wife, will have a son. Sarah was listening in the tent door, which was behind him. And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? So, what are we getting about, what do you think we can draw from some of these verses and expanding the context a little bit? Does this help us identify one of the people there? Well, it's the Lord. It says the Lord appeared to him. And he said, and so you see that beginning, the Lord appeared. And in 18:10 it says, he said, I will return to you. And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? I will return to you. So one of these three people is the Lord. Now, what we'll talk about and probably more expand on that would be something worthy of some thinking in your own study. And if you wanted to do some study, that might be a valuable thing to do. But what we'd understand from Scripture, we've talked about this. We'd understand the Bible says there is one God in three persons. It's the second person of the Trinity, not the Father, not the Holy Spirit, but the Son, who has the distinctive ministry of manifestation and incarnation. And so what we would understand is that this was the pre-incarnate Christ. And so theology terminology says either it's a theophany, which means an appearance of God, or a Christophany, an appearance of Christ. So before he was Jesus, he wasn't Jesus until he was named Jesus after his birth, he's the Son of God who came and manifested himself. But this is God personally appearing to Abraham.
See, it's all caps on the Lord.
Yes. So here it's all capital. There it's all capital. But when he bows down and says, in verse, where was that?
To the end of 2.
Yeah, in verse 3, my Lord, have I now found favor in your sight? You notice that's not all capitals. Now, it's an interesting thing. It's a very, the Hebrew word here is the, it could be, you could even translate it, sir. But the rabbis, I won't get too technical, but remind you, the Hebrew text is written in all consonants. So when you read a Hebrew newspaper in Israel, there's no vowels. You have to pay extra for those, just like the Jew. So when they wrote the Hebrew, they wrote it without vowels. The rabbis came in to make it easier to read in the synagogues and worship, and they put little points to there. They added the vowels. The vowels they put here, which were not like show, anyway, the vowels that they use here shows a very honoring Lord. So he, you know, you could translate it maybe exalted Lord or something like that. So it's not his divine name, Yahweh or Jehovah, but it shows great honor. And so did he recognize at that time it was the Lord? It's a good question to think about before Sunday. And you can be listening to see if I even answer that question. I'll be interested too.
On the Christophany, Theophany, like you said, I guess the appearances are usually the second person.
Yes.
So that they call Theophanies Christophanies?
Theoretically, I guess. Would all Theophanies be Christophanies? I'd have to think about that. Well, unless you just say maybe when he manifests his glory, and is that Christ? Oh, I'm not sure.
But Moses in the burning bush, was that?
That might, typically we might say that would be Christ, perhaps, because it was such a manifestation. Good question. So the burning bush, or just the glory that's present over the Ark of the Covenant in the tabernacle for all that time. I'd have to think about that. Good question. So all Christophanies are theophanies, but are all theophanies Christophanies?
Why would you have two words if it weren't different?
If they weren't different. Yeah, why would you have two words? Because you sound smarter if you have a little bit of a word. Good question, though. Yeah. So one of the persons, there's, how many men came and showed up with him?
Three.
And so one is God appearing as a man. So why does he call them three? Why are we told they're three men? They look like three men. So though one of them is God, he's appearing as a man. What about the other two? Here's some clues about them. So notice what I'm doing is I'm looking at the broader context. Let's follow these guys and see who they are. So in verse 22, the men turned away from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. So he went his way as soon as he has finished, verse 33, speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening. How many angels went into Sodom? Two. And so we start with three people. One is the Lord. Two angels go into Sodom, and notice they're separate. They turned away and went towards Sodom while Abraham was still talking to the Lord. So putting it all together, one of those who appeared to be a man was the Lord God. Two of them were angels. That was quite a lunch. Okay, that was quite a lunch. So, I mean, think about, it's easy to read over that passage, but stop for a minute and think. The Lord God, creator of all things, appeared as a man and came and had lunch with Abraham. And he had two angels with him. I mean, what an encounter. Okay. Now, here's the grounds for some research. How much meat is in a tender and good calf?
More than they need.
Yeah. Think about, okay, the typically, right, if you buy a calf, you figure if it's an 800-pound calf, you're going to get about 400 pounds of meat, right? That's the typical. I don't know, the younger they get, you probably, the numbers aren't quite the same. But, you know, and how old a calf, we're not told, but it was tender and good. What do you think tender and good means?
It's not a tough old bird.
Pardon me?
It's not a tough old bird.
It's not a tough old bird.
Would it be young, very young, I would think.
Be fairly young. Would it be kind of scrawny? Or is let's be honest, is the leanest beef the best beef? What do they always say? Look for marbling, of course. So it was probably young, but still it put on some. So how much weight is there? I can't imagine less than 100 pounds of meat. Now, am I thinking the wrong things when I'm reading my Bible? But I'm just trying to think through the mechanics of this. So he says, and then Barb helped raise the issue. How long does it take you to get a hamburger put together? Oh, terrible. What if you have to kill the calf? Shall we just say field dress the calf? We won't get too specific. Get the meat, harvest the meat, and make a meal.
Do you think maybe they just went for the steaks or something? You know, just chopped out what they needed?
I'm guessing you're right. Did they just go for the steaks? I'm sure they went for probably the best parts. And, yeah, they didn't necessarily have to cut up all the meat for the meal.
Isn't a young, tender calf veal?
I think a young, tender would be veal if it's, you know, in our terms, it doesn't do too much moving around and its diet is specific. But it would be something like veal. This is a very nice meal. This isn't the leftovers. Remember, by the way, in this part of the world, you have to remember at this time of this part of the world, everybody, how big were the freezers back then? And this is why when you hear a big celebration, they kill the fatted calf or maybe at least a goat. Because where we're so used to, Kroger's is having a sale, we'll buy up some extra beef and put it in the freezer. If you harvest a calf, you got to use it all because there is, there's salting and that kind of stuff. But so you have a big party because you're going to share. But maybe what's going on is they gathered the best meats for this meal, and the rest of it was shared.
What we don't hear about are the servants and all the people that are there to prepare to. So there's going to be in the background of all of this a lot of people too. Even though there's prominence given to the main characters, you don't hear about it. That's part of that culture where you have a lot of help.
Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, when he went to battle with Mamre against these other kings, he had over 300 servants in his home. Mm-hmm. So my guess is, harvest some good steaks for the guests, and then, but the servants are all kind of glad there's going to be a party. As soon as they get on the road, we're going to have some, and because it wasn't common to eat meat, not because they were vegetarians, but because, first of all, that's spending your capital. You know, that's spending your capital. And secondly, you got to eat it all. But when you've got 300 people to help, you could probably do it. Wow, actually, if you add 300, maybe some of the guests, you're left with sliders.
That's great, Seth. Those 300 servants were just the men.
Yeah, yes. Yes, so you're right. And and when you add the kids and all that, all of a sudden, that's not so surprising a deal. So, what does that tell us about the meal? It was a nice meal, but maybe on that food part, not so lavish. Now let's look about, and then it says he told his wife, get 3 measures of flour. And how do you figure out what a measure is? Okay, does anyone have a Christian Standard Bible with them. Mm-hmm. Do you have a marginal reading for that? Also, the ESV, is there a marginal explanation? And I'm asking because I already know the answer.
Seven quarts.
How many?
Seven quarts.
So here's where. So this is how, you know, sometimes you just ignore those little marginal notes. There, it's very helpful. What's a measure? How much flour is that? Seven quarts. So if he tells three measures, what are we talking? 21 quarts of flour. How many guests does he have?
Three.
Okay. So, I just started thinking this through a little bit. I said, so the bread he ate was probably like pita bread. You know what pita bread is? Just to help us put in the mood here, Barb's going to let y'all have a sample of pita bread. Yeah. But, so I just looked online. Here's how, you know, 3 cups of King Arthur unbleached all-purpose flour and all that stuff. This makes 8 pieces of pita, you know, about this big, mm-hmm. for 3 cups. Well, if a siah is 7 quarts, that's 28 cups. Well, basically, 3 measures would put up about 128 pieces of pita bread. Okay, so why so much? Now, the cow, you know, you can't just say, someone go get just one leg off one of the cows. We'll save the rest for later. But with the flour, you know, so why so much? Something to think about.
We need some hummus here.
Yeah, we need some hummus. Well, remember, it says in there, again, going back to the text real quickly.
Thank you.
Where's the tender and good
beef? And verse 8, so he took butter and milk and the calf which he prepared and set it before them. So they had some kind of milk or butter, milk, butter, cheese, something like that. Some of you will say curds. Anyway, pretty good meal. Now, again, here's what a pita looks like, just the regular size. One pita barely covers a plate if you fill it up. This is a typical Israeli falafel sandwich. Fried up chickpeas and tahina sauce and some other goodies. That'd be the equivalent of a hamburger on side of the road kind of a thing. That's what it looks like pretty much today. But you can also go to the market, and here's a Bedouin-style pita bread. Kind of flatter, and as you might notice, can you see what she's cooking here? Bigger. But if you look at these, it's probably about the same amount of flour, but just a lot more spread out. So this becomes more of a rack kind of thing. But just to give you a feel for what he offered, while we're trying to get a feel for the sense of it, here's a picture we took when we were in 2013 on our way to Petra in Jordan. So I saw some Bedouin tents. Bedouins are nomadic Arabs. And so this is their dwelling. And that's probably not unlike what Abraham's tent would have looked like. You see the flock here. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that always amazes me in this part of the world. What in the world are they eating?
Yeah.
It's just amazing to me. Here's a picture going back to the, I think, 1800s of Bedouins making butter. So they put milk into a skin, and you can see they're kind of pushing it back and forth. This is a sharing a meal. So,
what's
I mean,
in there? Grain or something?
There's a variety of things, but you can see the bones as well. They're picking away, and here was a feast in a home or a big supper in a guest chamber. kind of a feel for that. Now, again, I'm not guessing the servants, maybe some honored neighbors could have joined in, but probably the servants, I'm going to guess, ate later and had their own party after this was all passed up. But here's some notes from a commentator from the 1800s who visited the Middle East and made notes. He said, the sheikh's tent is always the first tent of the encampment. You know, they're always moving. You think especially, you get your flock on that kind of dry ground, you've got to keep moving. And so when they move, the sheikh's tent, the chieftain, his tent was the first one up. And it was placed in the direction that strangers are generally supposed to come in order that he might have the first opportunity of dispensing hospitality, specifically positioning the tent to have a good eye for the guests. Now, sometimes we have the attitude, we want to see them coming so we can hide in the back room, turn off the TV. But that's not here. It's like, I don't want to miss an opportunity of showing hospitality. It's a sacred thing in the Middle East. And then this guy goes on to describe, I'll go ahead and read a little bit more. Shortly after we'd returned to the sheikh's tent, an immense wooden bowl made its appearance, filled with the kid, a goat, which had been torn into small fragments and was swimming in butter and gravy. So here's the, you know, remember, he brought butter, he brought calf. Our appetites were too keen to be particular. Do you understand what he's saying? Mm-hmm. When you're really hungry, right? Whatever. So we all gathered round in a circle, and the sheikh, plunging his hand in, tore asunder several choice morsels, presented them to us, and then licked his fingers with delight. Piles of hot, thin cakes of unleavened bread, baked upon the hot ashes, and tough as leather, were brought in. Now, why did you think they gave unleavened bread? No time to rise, right? Do you think Sarah's bread had time to rise? I think that's simple. They're tough as leather. We're brought in, and being placed on our knees, they served the treble purpose of plates, napkins, and food. Water being a scarce commodity, we unfortunately couldn't picture, we could procure none to wash our fingers after this greasy repast. Not only is this true, but amongst the Bedouin Arabs, the killing of a sheep, calf, or kid in honor of a visitor is required by the laws of hospitality, and the neglect of it is keenly represented. So it's not like a law you're going to jail, but it's the social culture. If you don't offer up a feast, it's a grievous insult.
So that sounds like Abraham would have done that without my thinking.
I think that's the point. And by the way, how many guests do you think he had walking by that environment? You know, okay, this is not modern Hebron. It was an unusual thing, and it was a matter of survival. They have a dozen caustic terms of contempt for the sheikh who neglected to honor his guest with the usual sacrifice, as it is universally called, a name suggested of the religious rite of hospitality as practiced in ancient times by the patriarchs and frequently confirmed by solemn oath and covenant. So I just want to show those to you and give you a picture of it. And I often tell the story of when I was in living in Israel, went to visit a person in Nazareth, went and knocked on the apartment door, no answer. And so getting ready to leave, a neighbor opened their door, poked their head out the door and said, who are you looking for? So-and-so. They're not here. They're out of town. Okay, would you like to come in for a cup of tea? And I thought, what am I supposed to do? I don't want to, you know, in the South, with that they're offering, but you're politely supposed to decline. And so I thought, no, I probably need to say yes. Say yes. So, and it was the longest I've ever sat waiting for a cup of tea. And then finally, the whole family comes out, and there's this feast of various meats, and I didn't ask what they were. And there it was, and the family stood around and watched. So it's just, they didn't know me from the man in the moon. But there was an obligation. Here is a stranger on our doorstep. Hospitality is required. So that's kind of the picture of it, what's going on with Abraham. But in the practice of doing so, he has an encounter with the living God. And we go on in the context, which we won't get that far this Sunday. There'll be the promises about Sarah. So what are the some of the, as I'm thinking about how to preach this, what are some of the practical things I'm supposed to be saying? What are the takeaways from our personal Bible study as we look at that passage? Hospitality. Does any passage come to mind to support that idea?
The one that says, I can't remember where it is, that says that if you give someone a glass of water in my name.
Okay. So Matthew would...
You so, say the rest of it.
Yeah, if you do it to someone in my name, you did it to me. Okay.
Supposed to be given to hospitality.
Be given to hospitality.
Entertaining angels.
There's that verse, isn't there? Can anyone think where it is? Some have entertained, by doing so, some have entertained angels unawares. Anyone know where that is? There's your homework assignment.
It's in the Bible.
It's in the Bible? Old or New Testament?
It's not
New Testament. New Testament.
Hebrews.
Oh, we're
getting good. That's all I'm going to
give you for now. 3:2.
No, 13.
Did you just say that?
I'm not going to tell you. Okay. Look it up and find it out. But here's a verse that says, look, what do you think that passage is referring to? This one, at least. Because Abraham practiced hospitality, look at the opportunity he was blessed with. Or look at the opportunity with which he was blessed, if I want to be grammatically correct. But hospitality comes out of it, practically speaking, and theology comes out of it. Understanding Christophany, theophany, and again I see a mighty word all through the Old Testament, grace, that God would come and have that meal. And having read that about the fellow that was in the sheik's tent, now that Westerner, did you get his sense of his delight over the meal? As he watched the sheik licking his fingers, do you get the sense of, ugh.
What is that, missionary prayer?
Missionary prayer, yeah, kill everything in here, Lord, please. Yeah.
Oh, I was talking about the other one, that allowed me to eat what I can and that it'll stay down where it belongs.
That's, yeah, there you go. Well, here's the thing. If that's what a Westerner thinks as he goes to the Bedouin tent, what about the Holy God coming to that little tent in Hebron? You know, if we think we're being gracious because, I'll eat some sushi because it's polite. What if the God of glory? I mean, what picture of his grace that he would sit, wait for the meal, have a table conversation. What an incredible encounter of grace. And what does that tell me about his delight when I spend time with him? So those are some takeaways that we can start thinking about before Sunday.
How about humility? I don't know if he recognized who they were right away, but he runs out and falls down before them, considering them better than him.
Yes. So Abraham coming down and saying, oh, please, your servant and all that. Can I use a term? He's kind of like a Donald Trump. Can I say it like this? He's a very wealthy man by now. He has 1,000 servants or 300 male servants. He has vast herds and flocks. He's a man of significance. And he just sees three people walking along, and he treats them like royalty. Well, what does that show about his humility? Yeah.
They weren't even on camels or anything.
No, that just says he saw them standing there. Yes. Interesting. Yes.
Well, God had a great advantage over us because he created everything he was eating.
That's true. Yes, God is the creator, so he does, you know what it is.
Good. Judge those bacteria.
Maybe they didn't walk there. Maybe they just
Well, they didn't. They probably. But yes, it does seem like he just notices them. But they might have walked in from where he could have seen them approaching for a while. But in other words, he might have come from an angle that they couldn't see. Yeah. So. But and they're on their way, and then they're going to walk all the way on down to Sodom, apparently, and visit there. This is in the heat of the day. Sodom, when he gets there, it's towards evening, and that's why Lot's going to say, you know, time, let me, let, you know, you don't want to spend the night out here. So we kind of have, heat of the day, we're looking at noonish, 11 o'clock, noonish, something like that.
They couldn't have been too close because he ran.
Yeah.
The door to meet him.
And again, you know, in the ancient, in the Middle Eastern world, it is undignified to run. That's a display of grace. That he would run to meet them. He was completely humbling himself.
Peter did that, and the prodigal son.
Yeah, the prodigal son's father runs to meet him, and that's an incredible display of his humbling himself for a person that's been nothing but dishonoring to him. Good. Okay. Good.